Hello and welcome everybody back to it's Saturday and we are on our sutra study class. We are examining the Dharmapada. This is chapter 6 entitled The Sage. Before we start that, let's take a moment to appreciate our community gathered here today. Today I feel fortunate to sit as a member of this kind community in the safety and security of like-minded friends, sharing this present moment with others dedicated to the cultivation of goodness. Today, I'm grateful for the direction and support that this community provides, a community worthy of my time and commitment, a community where my efforts have meaning, purpose, and are appreciated. Today, I'm thankful for this community of awakening, a place to gain the knowledge and skills to improve my life, a family, a home, and a sanctuary for all of us seeking refuge from the storm. And let's remember, as conscientious practitioners, we must recognize our responsibility to the world, to strive to live skillfully while helping others to do the same, to strive to live in balance and harmony with nature and others, to strive to gain mastery over our minds and embody our true benevolent nature, to expand our hearts and minds, transcending our shared human limitations, to not intentionally harm sentient life or our planet, to maturely accept and embrace the reality of our situation while striving to improve it. Welcome everyone, I am Venerable Tarpa, and we are here for our Sutra Studies class. And as I mentioned, we're on the Dharmapada. This week we're working on Chapter 6, The Sage. I don't know about the rest of you, I hope everybody did their reading, by the way. I don't know about the rest of you, but I really enjoyed this chapter. This has been my favorite so far. Lots of really interesting information, and I thought it was quite uplifting and inspiring as well. In the different texts that we're using, one says the wise, one says the sage. So it's a little bit different in each one, but basically the same. Let's start by defining a little bit of what they mean by sage. So they use quite a few words to describe it. They talk about the sage being wise and discerning, virtuous, spacious, noble, tamed, trained, or controlled, free of defilements, being like a revealed treasure. That's really nice, huh? Always delighting in the Dharma, one who is unmoved by the eight worldly concerns, which we talked about last week. We'll talk about more this week. And freed from elation and depression. I thought that was a good one too. And lastly, the good friend. Isn't that nice? The sage is the good friend. I think in Buddhism we would, I forgot the term in Pali, Kalamitra or something, which means spiritual friend. So I like that your Buddhist teacher is the good friend. Anyways, I thought that was pretty cool. Why don't we get right to it? We have a few instructors here. Let's see who we got. Are the instructors able to read? Chantel, can you do some reading? Darcy? Neil, would you like to do a little reading yourself? Okay, and I can do some. I don't think I'm missing anybody. Good, let's do that. So, like always, let me put on the screen our texts. And we are starting with Gayden Chappell's text, and then we'll get into the others. So how about if I start the first one? So, not to make everybody nervous. So there's three verses in the first set. If you meet someone with wisdom who can tell you what to avoid and what to practice, attend upon this person as upon a revealer of treasure. For good and never evil comes from such association. Let them teach you and direct you and turn you from what is unwholesome. The pure in heart will rejoice in them, although the worldly will not like them. I thought that was strange, yeah? Do not take up with low-minded friends or associate with worthless people. Depend instead on virtuous friends and attend to noble beings. Some of them are a little hard to read. They don't roll quite off the tongue. Chantel, would you like to read the next three right there?
Sure, Tarpa. Should one find a man who points out faults and who reproves, let him follow such a wise and sagacious person as one would guide to hidden treasure. It is always better and never worse to cultivate such an association.
The next one.
Let him admonish, instruct, and shield one from wrong. He indeed is dear to the good and detestable to the evil.
And one more.
Do not associate with evil companions. Do not seek the fellowship of the vile. Associate with good friends. Seek the fellowship of noble men.
Thank you. Boy, did you do good with the vocabulary. There's a couple. What was the word? Sagacious. Wow. Boy, you did great. I'm glad I didn't have to read that. Darcy, would you like to read the next three?
Like someone pointing to treasure is the wise person who sees your faults and points them out. Associate with such a sage. Good will come of it, not bad. If you associate with one such as this, let one such as this advise you, instruct you, and restrain you from rude behavior. Such a person is pleasing to good people, but displeasing to the bad. Do not associate with evil friends. Do not associate with lowest of people. Associate with virtuous friends. Associate with the best of people.
Oh, thank you. So I think all these three are quite clear. There's not much need to talk about them. They're just talking about the benefits of being around great people, right? I thought it was interesting when they said that good people will be displeased by the bad people, right? That the evildoers, and they don't like sages. And that's interesting. That's an interesting take. And the thought that when you're on good people, only good comes, no bad. I don't know about that, but I know you don't get a lot of trouble. Like, I've had friends that were kind of fun, but they were kind of troublemakers. And it was always kind of, you always want to invite them to something, but there's always trouble when they come around. So I know what that means, you know. Do not associate with friends. What I didn't like was some of the language where they talked about what these lower people are like. And I think it was Bodorakita talked about these people being the vile, the detestable, and just generally, I don't like that the Dharmapala or any of the Buddhist texts refer to people that way. With SBT and a lot of my teachers that I study with, we don't view people as being evil. We don't see people as being vile. We simply see people like the vision the Buddha had of the lotus field, which we talked about, I think, in our second class, where upon enlightenment, the Buddha had a vision of a lotus field. Lotus grow from muck and mire and swamp and mud. And the Buddha saw humanity as this lotus field, and the fact that all of the different people in the world are simply at different stages of awakening. Some people are down in the mud and in the muck. Other people are rising above it. Some are starting to bud. Others are in full flower. But the point is that Buddhism doesn't believe in evil people. Buddhism believes that our true nature is good. Everyone's true nature is good, is benevolent. And what stops us from knowing that true nature is ignorance. So people aren't evil. People aren't vile. No one. People are ignorant. And for me, that's an important distinction to always keep in mind. I don't see anyone as being evil. And people that are very, very bad, I simply see as mentally ill. Right, because anyone that would behave like that, anyone in the right mind wouldn't behave like that, right? When you understand life, when you understand what leads to happiness, then those things you just simply wouldn't do. So Buddhism sees ignorance as being the catalyst for these people, and or very strong mental illness in some cases, where people can't be blamed for that. Okay, should we move on to the next one? There's a single one here. Neil, would you like to read one?
Yeah, there's a couple of comments in the chat.
Share them, please.
Yeah, Rick has put, unless it is a cult, then it could be bad to blindly and naively follow them. And Donna's put, the words such as vile were also disturbing for me.
Yeah, and Rick, you're right. You know, we always use wisdom. So I can look at a cult figure or a bad person, and I can see them as, I can have pity for them because I understand it's the ignorance that's the reason behind their behavior. It's not they themselves, they're trapped in ignorance or mental illness. But I have wisdom, and my wisdom doesn't let them get in the way of my happiness. So in Buddhism, all the aspects of qualities we deal with, we always bring wisdom. And so, yeah, we can have pity for that cult leader, but we can also stay away or help shut them down. We can use wisdom. And yeah, I don't like Donna. So far in the Dharmapada, you might have noticed there's been quite a bit of ugly language. And some of it, there's been some fairly violent terms when they talk about battling and using the sword to kill evil and things like that. And then they've, on numerous occasions, they've talked about people being vile. And especially they talked about people that don't know the Dharma are fools. Remember that from last week's? So I have a feeling that the Buddha would have never said things like that because of knowing the full range of the Buddha Dharma. I don't believe I would ever believe the Buddha would speak like that. But nevertheless, that kind of language trickles in. And what do we do? Neil, would you like to read number four?
Yeah. One who drinks deeply of the Dharma with a clear and open mind rests well. The wise always delight in the Dharma spoken by the saints.
Oh, that's lovely. And Darcy, would you like to read this one, 79?
Yep. He who drinks deep the Dharma lives happily with a tranquil mind. The wise man never delights in the Dhammapada, or in the Dhamma, made known by the Noble One, the Buddha.
Thank you. And Chantel, 79?
One who drinks in the Dharma sleeps happily with a clear mind. The sage always delights in the Dharma taught by the Noble Ones.
That's lovely. I don't think we need to say anything more about that. Let's move on to this one. I thought I numbered these, and I must have forgot to save them. So this one is going to be, I'm on the wrong one. Sorry, folks. This one's going to be 80. Okay. I'll try to master this. Number 80, I'll read this one. Farmers direct the flow of water. Arrowsmiths straighten the arrow shaft. Carpenters fashion wood. The wise work on themselves. Neil, would you like to read 80?
Yeah. Irrigators regulate the rivers. Fletchers straighten the arrow shaft. Carpenters shape the wood. The wise control themselves.
And Chantel, number 80.
Irrigators guide water, fletchers shape arrows, carpenters fashion wood, sages tame themselves.
Oh, that's lovely. And this is a long one. We have 81 to 84. Darcy, would you like to read this one?
Solid rock is not moved by wind. The wise are never unsettled by praise or blame. Just as the depths of a lake are pure and untroubled, so the wise, hearing the holy Dharma, become crystal clear. And Holy beings do not communicate personal desires in any situation, for happiness and misery are all the same to them. Elation and depression are not found in the wise. If you have no desire for sons, for wealth, or for estates, either for yourself or for the sake of others, and desire no good fortune through wrong means, you are possessed of ethics, knowledge, and the Dharma.
Oh, that's lovely. And Chantal, would you like to read this one? There's four.
Just as solid rock is not shaken by the storm, even so the wise are not affected by praise or blame. On hearing the teachings, the wise become perfectly purified like a lake deep, clear, and still. The good renounce attachment for everything. The virtuous do not prattle with a yearning for pleasures. The wise show no elation or depression when touched by happiness or sorrow.
Thank you.
Carry on?
Yeah, I think, is that the last one? Is it through 80? Yeah, one more. Read 84 for us.
He is indeed virtuous, wise, and righteous, who neither for his own sake nor for the sake of another does any wrong, who does not crave for sons, wealth, or kingdom, and does not desire success by unjust means.
Oh, thank you. And I'll read this last one. As a solid mass of rock is not moved by the wind, so a sage is unmoved by praise and blame. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma. Virtuous people always let go. They don't prattle about pleasure and desire. Touched by happiness and then by suffering, the sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. A person who would not wish for success by unethical means, not for the sake of others, not for the sake of themselves, not for the hopes for children, wealth, or kingdom, is a person of virtue, insight, and truth. So this one has a bit to unpack. I think it's pretty good. So first of all, the first verse, when we talk about the sages are moved by praise and blame, again, we're getting into the eight worldly concerns like we talked about last week, if you remember those. I'm going to post that again for everybody in our social media in case you missed it last week. But that seems to be the ongoing thought throughout this. The next one is, as a deep lake is cleared and disturbed, so is a sage by understanding the Dharma. And this line is interesting. Virtuous people let go. So in 83 we had, they talk about renouncing. So let go is another term for renouncing. And very nice. So hope I'm not making anybody seasick when I go through these quickly. So virtuous people learn to renounce. And what are they renouncing? They're renouncing attachment for the world, right? So renouncing is an important term in Buddhism. The term, it's translated in Tibetan in a very unusual way. The meaning of, or interpreted, the meaning of renunciation from the Tibetan point of view is the wish for freedom. So in the West, we think about renouncing as quitting something or letting something go. But the Tibetans think about it as an intention, that renunciation is the wish for liberation. It's the wish for freedom. And then it accompanies the idea that, well, these are the things we need to let go of in order to get that freedom. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about virtuous people always let go. But we're not letting go of things necessarily. We're letting go to that of the attachment to things. Now, especially as monastics, there's things we let go of. We're celibate, we don't drink alcohol. So you can completely get rid of things, you know, red meat in your diet, whatever it is. But generally, when we talk about renunciation. It's renouncing our attachment to things. So that's much different than renouncing things. Like we talked about sense pleasures last week when we had a bit of a debate on that. Well, what do they mean? Just not liking anything from the senses? Like what happens if you're looking upon the Buddha or you're at a Dalai Lama teaching and you're just enjoying the view so much? Of course, those are dharmic, those are virtuous, right? So it's the attachment to that. And in a lot of cases, even attachment to virtuous things can be problematic, right? So that's the idea there. And then they say they don't prattle about pleasure and desire. Prattle is a new word for me. It's an interesting word linked to vocabulary, to speech. And it's kind of bickering and worrying about and gossiping and prattling. Oh, he's such a prattler. So they don't go on and on about pleasure and desires. Touched by happiness and then by suffering, the sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. And here we're talking about the extremes of the experience of life, right? We're talking about, because I believe some elation is okay. When I meet the Dalai Lama, I'm quite elated. But again, they're talking about problematic at the far extreme, and then the other extreme. This is 83. I wanted to see this one. Gideon Chappelle has an interesting thing when he says, holy beings do not communicate personal desires in any situation, for happiness and misery are all the same to them. This is a very, very deep thought. And they talk about in Buddhist practice, especially in the Zen tradition, of getting to the point where all things in life has one taste, which means that you understand that good and bad are just extremes of the spectrum of life experience, right? So the experience of life itself is a spectrum. At one end, we have the good, the stuff we like. At the other end, we have the stuff that we don't like, right? This comes into feelings from our five aggregates, if you've studied those. And the fact is that life is always somewhere between those, right? And it's not so much good and bad. They're all just aspects of life. So the sage accepts this. And also in Buddhism, we accept that we might not enjoy our suffering, which makes sense. But at the same time, we can still appreciate the good qualities that often come from our suffering. If you think about it, all of the qualities that we admire most are qualities that come from our suffering, right? Maturity, patience, understanding, wisdom, compassion is another one. You know, without suffering ourselves, how can we ever have compassion for others? So Buddhists appreciate both. And so he's moved away from the extremes of elation and depression. And they're not found in the wise. So again, he's moving past the extremes of the eight worldly concerns, right? Of happiness and sadness. Okay, I thought that was an important one. The last one, let me see the last one here. A person who does not the person's virtuous. Let me see which one of these is the best. I like this one, 84. He is indeed virtuous, wise, and righteous, who neither for his own sake or the sake of another does any wrong, who does not crave sons, wealth, kingdom, and does not desire success by unjust means. That says it for itself. That's quite lovely. Okay, and we're on to 84. Oh, we're on to 85. Neil, would you like to read one? Which one are we in here? 85, I think we're on this one.
Yeah. Of our many beings run up and down the water's edge, only a few will reach the other shore.
I really like this one. Okay, there's two of them to this one. Could you read the next one?
Yeah. It is difficult to find one way across to the realm of death, but those who follow the teachings of the one who teaches the truth will reach the other side.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you. Darcy, would you like to read 85 and 86?
Sure. Few among men are those who cross to the farther shore. The rest, the bulk of men, only run up and down the hither bank. Those who act accordingly to the perfectly taught Dhamma will cross the realm of death, so difficult to cross.
Oh, that's funny. And Chantel?
Which one's Tarpa?
85 right here on the screen.
Right. Few are the people who reach the other shore. Many are the people who run about on the shore. Good. But those who are in accord with the Dharma, with the well-taught Dharma, will go beyond the realm of death, so hard to cross.
Oh, I love this one. What did you guys think of this one? That I never thought about it like this before, but yeah, we have, few beings are gonna be able to cross the river to the other shore of enlightenment. But isn't it true that there's so many people gathered on the shore, huh? And I dare to say, I guess we're all gathered on the shore as well, aren't we? And we all are kind of like the lotus field. We're all in different stages of entering the river, aren't we? Some of us just have our toes in, testing out the water, seeing the temperature. Others are up to our knees, some are up to our waist. But I thought that was a great image of all these people on the shore and all bickering about the best way to get across, right? Everybody claiming they have the perfect way to get across, but few people will make it to the other side. And of course, the next verse says about the same thing. It's difficult to find one's way across the realm of death. Remember that the realm of death here is samsara, right? It's to get off this side of the shore. But those who follow the teachings, they'll reach the other side. So basically they say the same thing. It's difficult to cross the river, but the Dharma is a good way to do it. Oh, that was great. I liked that one very much. Okay, we're on 87 and 88. Boy, if I don't number them, it becomes quite difficult. And how about if I read one? The wise forsake the path of darkness and cultivate the way of light, going where life is hard escaping from the householder's life to find joy in the homeless state of solitude. The wise desire happiness, give up all that they desire, and thus subdue all the emotional turmoil of the mind. And because Chantel does so good with big words, she can do 87, 88 here.
Abandoning the dark way, let the wise man cultivate the bright path. Having gone from home to homelessness, let him yearn for that delight in detachment, so difficult to enjoy. Giving up sensual pleasures with no attachment, let the wise man cleanse himself of defilements of the mind.
Thank you. That's lovely. And Darcy, 87 and 88 here.
Those who fully cultivate the factors of awakening give up grasping and join.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I missed one.
Where are we?
Right.
Yeah, up here, giving up darkness.
There we go. Giving up dark ways, sages cultivate the bright. They go from home to homelessness to the solitude so hard to enjoy. There they should seek delight, abandoning sensual desires. Having nothing, sages should cleanse themselves of what defiles the mind.
So I love that the idea of dark and light come in here, as they do in every spiritual tradition. And I think it's apropos. I think it's a great image of light being warm and guiding. They often talk about the Buddhist teachers and Buddhist sages as holding a lamp for others, that they light the way of the path. So I really like this idea. And coming out of darkness, darkness is a nice analogy for ignorance, right? And so, but what's interesting here is the bright way is the way out of homeless, out of the home, out of householder life, right? That's back here. For those cultivated, the life is to escape the householder's life, is to come out of darkness. So this, of course, a lot of the scriptures lean towards monasticism, right? That, especially the Theravada tradition, that monasticism is the only proper way to practice the Dharma, which the Mahayana disagree with, as well as we. We don't agree with that one bit. I've met some really bad practitioners that were monastics, and I've met some amazing practitioners that were householders. But nevertheless, that is the idea at the time. And moving to the homeless state of solitude. Now, some people would also say that you could look at householder's life and homeless life as just attachment. It's not necessarily having a householder's life, but a type of householder's life that you're consumed with attachments and things. And we can all know, we all know people that are like this, right? Their only concerns are the house and all the things they have. And there's a trapping there for householders that you can get really caught up in attachment. And then the homeless state could be living an unattached state. So please, lay people, do not feel left out about that one. The wise desire happiness, give up all that they desire, and thus subdue all the emotional turmoil of the mind. So let's see if we have a better one for that. So Bodha Rakita says, give up sensual pleasures. And again, it's the attachment to sensual pleasures, because here he says with no attachment, right? He's actually saying that. Let the wise man cleanse himself of defilements of the mind. Yeah, I think we have enough said. If anybody has any comments about any of these things, you can chat them in the, you can type them in the chat box, or you can interrupt me, please. But when I have all these things on my screen, it's impossible for me to see everybody. And not Anil, if anybody raises their hand, please interrupt me and let me know. Okay, we have our last verse, which is 89. Neil, would you like to read this one?
Yeah, someone's just put something on the chat for a second. Donna's written, I did feel 87 and 88 were
elitistic. Oh, elitist. Oh, yeah. Now, you know, you got to get used to it, because we're going to hear a lot of language about why monastics are better than everyone else. We're going to hear a lot of language of why men are better than women. We're going to hear a lot of language about why Dharma practitioners are elitist towards others. As far as being an egalitarian tradition, they often say Buddhism is the first egalitarian tradition. It doesn't show in these writings. And so again, I often think, I think that there's been a lot of additional material added to a lot of these scriptures. And I don't think I see the Buddha possessing this kind of ill will. Yeah. So it's an old book. We're just going to have to be patient and have our own modern take on it. And just be happy that we don't do that. So the more we read, the more you're going to like SBT. Right? Makes us look really good. Neil, would you like to read the last one?
Yeah. Cultivating the factors of enlightenment with the pure mind of meditation, you will stop all grasping, taking no delight in attachment and destroying all defilements. Full of light, you are completely passed beyond the suffering of this world.
Oh, sign me up. That sounds lovely. And 89, Chantal, would you like to read this one?
Those whose minds have reached full excellence in the factors of enlightenment, who having renounced acquisitiveness, rejoice in not clinging to things, rid of cankers, glowing with wisdom, they have attained nirvana in this very life.
Thank you. And Darcy, would you like to read the last one, 89?
Those who fully cultivate the factors of awakening, give up grasping, enjoy non-clinging, and have destroyed the toxins, are luminous and completely liberated in this life.
Thank you. Oh, I didn't know we could become luminous. That's pretty good. Hey, let's talk quickly about what the seven stages, the seven factors of awakening are. And I thought I have them here somewhere. Oh, I think they're further down. I can never remember all my numbered lists. They actually have a book in Buddhism called the Book of Numbers. There's so many lists of numbered things, they actually made a book about it. Can you believe that? The seven factors of enlightenment are mindfulness, investigation, effort, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. Isn't that lovely? So people that have fully embraced that, you can also simply say people that have fully embraced the Dharma, they give up grasping. They give up the grasping at attachments, right? And enjoy non-clinging. They enjoy non-attachment and have destroyed the toxins. So in Buddha Khitas, they call them cankers, which if you, in the West, cankers are like horrible sores that, I don't know where you get them. I've heard of them. You get them on your body and they're like open sores that hurt badly. And but the cankers here are more related to the fetters. In Buddhism, they call them the 10 fetters, or just the all the defilements and limitations that create ignorance and cause us to suffer. And then by destroying those, as you can imagine, luminosity, right? We're completely enlightened in this lifetime. I want some luminosity. Luminosity is a word used a lot in Tantric Buddhism. They talk about the luminous mind. And I'm intrigued by this last verse. Those whose minds have reached full excellence in the factors of enlightenment, who having renounced inquisitiveness, that's one that I just have to question. There must be a reason for the use of that word. It's not in the others. I mean, inquisitiveness is something that's praised in Buddhism, to be inquisitive about the teachings. But here, I wonder if it's kind of in a negative way. Darcy?
I think it's acquisitiveness, more like acquiring.
Oh. Acquisitiveness. Acquisitiveness. Thank you, Darcy.
I see the first part being like acquire. I don't know.
Ah, and there's a note here. Let's see what the note says down here. So it says the verse describes the arhat, the sage, dealt with more fully in the following. So we talk about that in the next chapter. The cankers are the four basic defilements of sensual desire, desire for continued existence, false views, and ignorance. And in Tibetan Buddhism, a few of those are the causes of ignorance themselves. So, thank you. Yeah, I didn't read the word correctly. Acquisitiveness. I am not going to show off my limited education by dealing with that. But yeah, wanting to acquire, right? Not being into attachment. Thank you. And again, in this one, it says taking no delight in attachment. So that's what they mean. Destroying all defilements, full of light and luminous. You will completely pass beyond the suffering of this world. Who wants to sign up for that? That one sounds pretty good. Yeah, don't you? Huh? Okay, I'm going to shut this off. Yeah, very good. So, does anybody have any questions, comments, or insights into today's reading? Yes, Darcy.
Could you post the numbers of of enlightenment, stages of enlightenment?
The seven? Yeah, I sure will. Okay. The seven factors of enlightenment?
Yeah, maybe on Facebook or in the...
Okay, and I'll post this as well, what we had last week, the eight worldly dharmas, or the eight worldly concerns. And these extremes are what a sage wouldn't be interested in. The sage would be comfortably in the middle of all of these, right? So I'll post that as well. I certainly will. Any other comments?
Me, Donna.
Yeah,
I was wondering if there were a book of all these lists, a number book, which you said there was. Where?
Yeah.
I want to read all these lists. Just compile it myself. It's just a pain in the butt.
Just Google it. You'll find it. It's a popular book. The Buddhist, I don't know if it's the Tibetan Book of Numbers or the Buddhist Book of Numbers.
Okay.
But I might even have it somewhere in my PDF collection. But
okay.
Yeah, and I just can't keep up with all the numbers of this and that, and the 35 and the 37 and the 10. And
I was also thinking that even with the words that kind of made me cringe a little bit, I thought it was a very positive chapter.
I did too. Yeah. And, you know, so basically, it seems like the whole chapter is talking about the benefits of a spiritual teacher, of a good spiritual teacher, right? Yeah, I was waiting for the compliments to start flowing. and this was particularly an interesting chapter for myself, because though I don't call myself a sage, it's definitely part of my job description, I think. So I'm moving in that direction. And a lot of these chapters really, I apply some insight. And I think, well, where am I? Am I depressed or elated? I think I'm doing pretty good on that one. So I'm on my way, I think, if nothing else. I had a couple of hands raised. David is one.
Go ahead, David.
You're muted.
Sorry, people. For me, the crucial thing with following a wise teacher is knowing whether they're really wise, because that's the trouble. Nobody would follow an unwise teacher if they could see that they were unwise. That would just be stupid. And some of the deluded teachers, I've met a couple, are very persuasive and very articulate and very loving. And it's making that discernment from whether they are actually a dead end or whether they actually lead somewhere. That's the challenge for me. It's not the advice to don't follow poor teachers. It's spotting poor teachers that's the big challenge.
I have a feeling some advice for that is coming up in the readings. Many people here have heard your story, David. David has been in the spiritual game for a long time, and he's followed quite a few greats and not so greats. So, you know, David, it's the same for everything in life. You know, whether you're talking a financial advisor, or you're talking about a doctor, or you're talking about a teacher for your kids and a kid's education or fitness, it's like, This is just something we have to deal with in every aspect of our lives, trying to find those people. Now, the good news is in Buddhism, they go into great detail into what a good spiritual teacher is. I have a lot of it written in my text, Tibetan Buddhist Essentials, in Volume 3. And maybe I can post some of those bits online. And there's a criteria especially for a tantric teacher, because tantric teachers are quite unique, and you're supposed to follow a teacher for like 11 years before taking them as a guru, and they list all the qualities that they should have. But ultimately, at the end, there's always a risk. You just never know, because you're right, the crooks are really good. Like when people talk about Osho, and they, what do you think about Osho? And I think, oh, he's the most dangerous man in spirituality. He was just a horrible, hideous man who did terrible things and stole everybody's money. And they say, yeah, but he's so good. His books are so good. And I tell them, yeah, crooks are really good. That's how they're crooks. If they weren't good at it, he wouldn't be popular. So, but the point is that you shouldn't read his books, because you don't know which parts are legitimate, which parts aren't, which parts are leading your mind in the wrong direction, or which ones aren't. And, you know, nowadays what's nice is we have the internet, so you can research people. You can, you know, like the Dalai Lama, what a safe teacher. I mean, no controversies in his path. He's an old guy, he's been doing it for a long time. So you have to seek these out. But as many of you know, recently, there's been all kinds of spiritual teachers getting in trouble because of things that they've done. And sometimes you can't research it. And you know what? Even when people research it and they find these things out, oftentimes people just deny it. Like with Sogyal Rinpoche recently, everybody knew about all his goings on. They just were all in a state of denial. So a lot of it has to do with the student as well. I mean, if you're looking to be saved by somebody at all costs, you'll overlook all those things. But here in SBT, we learn how to be, you know, to be discerning and to not let our desires cloud our vision. We're very smart folks here. Darcy?
Yeah, as far as the verses that we're reading, and there's like three different, I could definitely see a secular slant on all of these and yeah. Writing something like that, oh writer.
Writing a secular Dharmapada, huh? Oh yeah, I'll put it on my heap of work to do right away. Darcy's trying to kill me, everybody. And don't take your heart medication when you're writing it, Tarpa. No, she loves me very much. I'm just teasing. But yeah, you're right. We have to read between the lines. You know, we did a book club for a while, and we decided to read Padmasambhava's Way of the Bodhisattva, and which is a book that I remember just loving, like one of my favorite books, one of the Dalai Lama's favorite books. And then when we started reading it, I couldn't believe how dogmatic and religious it was. And just heavy like this one is. And, you know, about a few weeks in, I thought, we really can't teach this at all for a secular Buddhist group. It's just way too religious. And so maybe we'll find that's true with the Dharmapada as well. But the fact is that this is the nature of the traditions and the teachings. And I think, again, I said it in joke, but I think it's true that it does, again, highlight how needed SBT is and that we're here as a group. I think we really do need this. Darcy, I'm trying to do Tarpa into... Ah, thanks. I think he could write a secular version, yeah. Actually, yeah, right
we
now...
We have a second. Do I hear a third?
Right now, I'm working on...
I seconded you, Darcy. Sorry.
I'm working on a text called... Secular Buddhist Essentials, which will be our curriculum. So I got to do that first, yeah. Yeah, okay. Any other points of interest?
Tarpa, I just had a question on the use of the very strong language, for example, vile and the like, and perhaps it's because of the time that it was written in. At that time, they didn't have the complexity, the understanding of the complexity of people as characters, nor the complexity of the lives that we're living right now. And I like the word of mental, or the phrase mental illness, to describe very severe, you know, sort of behavior. Because if you use that term, the reaction would be, you know, if a person has mental illness, perhaps they need help. Otherwise, if you call them vile, perhaps you want to crucify them. So I think perhaps it's because of the time that it was written in, that the particular language was used.
I think you're absolutely correct. And I think you can imagine, you know, just over the last 100 years, how much our language has moved towards sensitivity of mm-hmm. using, you know, sensitive language. So back then, yeah, maybe they were quite crude and they just, you know, saw everything very binary. Mm-hmm. But remember, we talk about often that in Dharma, you always know it's true Dharma when it moves out of the binary. If I can see the Buddha being so much caught up in binary, other than general binaries like virtue and non-virtue. I mean, he has those distinctions to be able to teach, but just generally more deeply philosophical thoughts, when they're trapped in binary, then you know that it's not as deep as it should be. So I agree, yeah. But I have a feeling that it's the it's the rewriters of these texts, the monks who, because there is a lot of heavy stuff that it kind of comes more from the teachings that they give to monks than they do to lay people. So many people question that. In my research of the Dharmasana, many people research that. They think that the Dharmapada is kind of a heavy version of a lot of these topics. I agree. Mm-hmm. Probably more coming from the commentaries of Buddha Ghosa in the 5th century, who was very pro-monastic, and they often say that you know, Dharma took a very religious turn where Bodhidharma comes in. And I think in Tibetan Buddhism, I think Shantideva takes Tibetan Buddhism in a very religious direction. That's a little bit I know. Would anybody else like to share? I enjoyed it. Next week, we got a cool one, the Arhat. We're getting deeper into what the sage is. Arhat is the highest level of practitioner of the and level of attainment of the Theravada school. It's just about a Buddha, but you don't call them Buddhas. You call them Arhats. Or Arahant in Pali and Sanskrit. Okay, we're catching up on the hour. How about we wind things in with a little bit of commentary? So in conclusion, I just kind of wanted to go over some of the main themes of it. So they're pretty much saying that having a relationship with the sage is a good thing, always leads to good. Meeting a person who can guide you towards goodness is something that is as rare as treasure. Someone who can constructively point out your faults and remind you of them. And here I make the note of our vows, because it's not just someone who can do these things, it's also a system that can do these things. And with many of us who are holding refuge, bodhisattva or monastic vows, that's the job of the vows also. The vows keep us in that constructive direction and remind us of our values. Interestingly, the sage is said to be loved by the virtuous and despised by the unwholesome. I don't know if I've ever felt despised by unwholesome people. I seem to do pretty good across the board. Maybe it's because I'm not advanced enough. I don't know. They give the advice to be discerning in the company that you keep and in who you consider friends. I think this is important, but I've seen people take it too far, and I've seen people seem to just abandon everybody who they believe aren't up to the level that they are. I think that can be a dangerous thing to do. But I think it's always a question of distance, right? We negotiate and we traverse our world with this idea of distance. And we even use it in our language. We have close friends and we have distant friends, right? No matter what it is, things we enjoy, we bring closer, and things we don't, we push further away. So this idea of distance is a spectrum instead of being a binary. Who do I like and who do I reject? The spectrum is there. And so this is a better way to apply this. Just people that are unwholesome and maybe not so good for you, or they cause trouble, you know, they're better to hold at a safe distance. Because like it or not, we do get influenced by the people that are around us. And then they say to associate with the good, the wise, the noble, never with evil, vile, or the lowest of human beings, one of them says. Oh, that's terrible. I do not look at human beings like that. For those who drink the Dharma in deeply with an open mind, life is delightful. I agree with that. The wise work diligently on taming, training, improving, and controlling themselves. The wise delight in detachment. And, or you could say, I was writing about this the other day. And, kind of lessening our discernment of things, you know, our likes and dislikes, taking in the world as one taste, you know. It's fine to have preferences. It's fine to like spaghetti over salad or whatever, or chocolate over vanilla, but to move away from, choicelessness is the word I'm looking for. To me, that's what this means, to the wise delight in detachment, practicing a choicelessness, you know, just getting better at just accepting things. You know, ice cream, whatever flavor you got. I have a preference, but I don't care. I'll just take whatever you got. The wise let go of their attachment to everything and are not moved by the eight worldly concerns, and therefore transcend the extremes of elation and depression. In other words, they have become mentally and emotionally stable, which is a good thing. The sage is one who is freed from the extremes of the eight worldly concerns. They possess ethics, knowledge, and dharma. Many gather on the shore, but few reach the other shore of enlightenment. That was my favorite takeaway. That's a great image. I just see all these people on one shore arguing with each other and pushing each other around, and everybody trying to gather people under their spot of the shore. Come with us. We know how to get there. They talk about, although samsara is difficult, it is possible for those who follow the Buddha's teaching. Some of these I think I don't need to read. The wise, they want happiness. They give up desires and thereby eliminate mental and emotional turmoil. So it's true, our attachment to desires and just strong desire, it definitely gets in the way of our happiness. And those who cultivate the factors of enlightenment, which again are mindfulness, investigation, effort, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity, eliminate all grasping and are made full of light. They pass beyond sorrow and gain nirvana. I want to be in that group. So, in closing, remember that these sutra teachings are meant as practice instructions. So, in order to get the greatest benefit, we need to engage fully with them. Utilize the three great objectives of study, contemplation, and meditation. Your work this week is to discover how these teachings apply in your daily life, transforming them from words on a page into living Dharma. Next week, we'll be moving on to chapter 6 of the Dharmapada, which is, seven. I forgot to change my notes, and which is the Arhat. So I am super excited to share that with you. And without further ado, let's end today's class with our altruistic prayer. May all be healthy, may all be prosperous, may all be well, may all be present, free of past regret and future worry. May all abide in constant appreciation, which is a source of great joy and contentment. May all realize their true nature and the true nature of reality, which is awakening. Thank you, everybody, for joining me for another successful sutra class. I'm getting a lot out of the program. I enjoy it very much. There's important news. Tomorrow's the big day. We got our day of observance and retreat. One day out of the month that we set aside for ourselves, for our practice, for our relaxation, for our comfort, and to meet with friends, to eat some good food, and to practice. So I hope everybody's going to come, and today you're going to spend some time getting ready and getting all your food in place and all your ice cream lined up in the freezer waiting for you. It's going to be a blast. And one more news, we just did an update to our Introduction to Secular Buddhism, and I think it's really great. There's a lot of new information in it. We actually simplified it. It used to have an Introduction to Buddhism with then an Introduction to Secular Buddhism. So we took away the first, made it shorter. It's only 10 pages, but it shares my own story of my path to secular Buddhism throughout the monasteries. It talks about my own personal view of secular Buddhism, and it might be a good reading. Might be good reading material for tomorrow's retreat, as Tenzin Zopa talked about. So you can download that from our website or from our social media. Yes. Oh, tomorrow would be a good day to catch up on my writing. Yeah. Thank you, Darcy. Yeah. I'll be sure to have a nurse standing next to me.
I was typing it as you were saying it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny. Yeah. So great class. Thanks to everybody for joining me. We'll see you tomorrow for the big day.
Thank you, Tarpa.
Also, thanks to everybody for all the donations that came in for our fundraiser. You guys were so generous, and I have enough to get back to America and buy all my medications. I couldn't be happier. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Tarpa.